I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Super Tuesday. I guess the first part of this hour, former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich a few days ago said, I endorse Bernie Sanders for president of the U.S. He's leading a movement to reclaim America for the many, not the few. And such a political mobilization, a political revolution, as he puts it, is the only means by which we can get the nation back from the moneyed interests that now control so much of our economy and democracy. We have so much to talk about with Robert Reich. He is Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley and Senior Fellow at the Center for Developing Economies. He did serve, as I said, as Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. He has written 14 books. The latest is Saving Capitalism. He is founding editor of the American Prospect magazine and recently stepped down as chair of Common Cause as he announced his support for Senator Bernie Sanders for president. We'll be talking about Super Tuesday as well. We will also look at Donald Trump because Robert Reich says he keeps getting asked if Donald Trump will survive his failure to disavow the KKK. We'll find out his answer to that. And Professor Robert Reich, thank you so much for being with us again. Hi.
Well, Kathleen, it's delightful to be with you. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you just fine.
All the way from Berkeley.
All the way from Berkeley. You're not on the campaign trail yet?
No, I'm not. I am a professor. I've got students to teach here.
Okay. And I'm sure your students have a lot to say that's all about all that's going on. Oh, my gosh, all that's going on. You indicated, I think, with a tweet today that Senator Sanders has said that he intends to, and he has the money to do it, take this all the way to the convention. Because do you think he's leading a political revolution in addition to wanting to be president, that the former might be more important?
Yes. Well, I think there are two things going on. Obviously, there's a candidate who wants to be president, and I have endorsed that candidate. I think Bernie Sanders would be a great candidate. But beyond that, we also have a movement that is a political movement. He calls it a political revolution, but it really is the only way to mobilize and organize and energize Americans sufficiently to get substantial change and get big money out of our politics, Kathleen, and also reorganize the economy. So instead of most of the gains going to a small group at the top, there is widespread prosperity. You can't do that with business as usual in Washington.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about his leading a movement to get that big money out of politics. Hillary isn't. To you, that's the biggest difference. What's the problem with big money in politics?
Well, if we didn't have so much wealth and income concentrated at the very top, it would be less of a problem, but the combination is really devastating. When you have so much of a kind of an oligarchy, a kind of another gilded age, as we had in the 1890s, replicated now in the American economy, where most middle-class people are not making it. In fact, the middle class is shrinking, and the ranks of the poor are growing. The only ones who are making it are at the very top, and they, many of them, are putting their money into American politics. They're tilting the playing field. They are rigging the economic game in ways that make them even richer. There's no end to that. I mean, you can understand that that is a vicious cycle that will get worse and worse unless it's reversed. And that's what this movement must do.
So much has been written, and I want you to speak to this attraction people are having for Bernie Sanders and then the maybe reflecting the same angst, Donald Trump. The median family income, you remind us, lower now, which is incredible, than it was 16 years ago. Adjusted for inflation, most economic gains have gone to the top. It seems as though the support for that group of people, and there are many of them, is going to both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. But Donald Trump is winning. Why?
Well, I think that when people are scared and they feel like the game is rigged against them, they're going to turn in one of two directions. And this is the way people who have been scared economically in history have turned, either toward a strongman who is authoritarian and who says, look, I'm going to be a bully toward all of the people who have bullied you, and just follow me. Don't worry about my policies. Also, someone who preys upon the prejudices and uses the politics of resentment to scapegoat others. Or they're going to turn to somebody who says, look, we've got to come together and make a political revolution, which I think in this case is certainly Bernie Sanders. And that's, I think, where the fuel is coming from in this campaign. on both sides.
Mm-hmm. But he's certainly, Donald Trump is appealing so much to prejudices. There's something very sad about the state of American society. If what he is saying that is so bullying, that is so racist in many ways and so unwelcoming, so not the way we think of America, is attractive to so many Americans, don't you find that discouraging?
Well, I'm troubled by it, Kathleen. Discouraged? No, I'm never discouraged. I think that what this has got to be is a warning shot over the bow of the establishment parties, both Republican and Democrat, that if they allow to, you know, allow so many Americans to become so unhappy, so desperate. Two-thirds of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. As you pointed out, as I have said, the median wage, the typical family, is worse off today than they were in the year 2000, even though the economy is much larger. If the establishment allows that to continue, then demagogues are going to crop up. It's not just Donald Trump. It will be a continued parade of demagogues. We're going to actually lose what's best about America.
Mm.
Obviously I'm concerned about that, but my deepest concern is the conditions that are fueling Donald Trump.
You wrote recently an open letter to the Republican establishment. What did you say?
Well, I said that they're being hoisted on their own petard, that they've been, you know, contributing hundreds of millions of dollars over the years to the Republican Party, and look what they've done. Look what they've got. Number one, a shrinking middle class incapable of having the purchasing power to buy the products that the captains of industry need them to buy, which means that economic growth is stymied, the stock market is fragile. Number two, they're not allowing government. The government doesn't have the revenues to invest in infrastructure, basic research and development, education, to provide the kind of skilled workers that American industry needs. And number three, they are fomenting by keeping wages down and also being as greedy as they are, the CEOs and Wall Street and the captains of American industry. They are fomenting this backlash against the establishment in some very ugly ways that is leading to polarization, name-calling, racism, and tarnishing America's moral authority around the world, which is also very bad for American business.
So the
establishment, the corporate and Wall Street establishment, is really has caused themselves, because of their own short-sightedness, they've caused themselves enormous headaches.
Mm-hmm. Are we seeing the death of the Republican Party? Is there something major going on right now with that party?
Yes, I don't think there's any coherent Republican Party left. I mean, there are a group of people who are call themselves libertarians. There's some who don't like government, some big businesses who love government subsidies and bailouts and crony capitalism. There are others who really just are buying into the bigotry and xenophobia and anti-immigration line. These are all different tribes inside the Republican Party, and when you actually look at the party itself, there's almost nothing there. These are all independent tribes that are raising their own money, having their own candidates, and really have very little in common.
Let's talk a little bit more about Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. I was reading in the New York Times, I didn't realize it was this much money. Secretary Reich made $11 million in the last 2 years in speaking engagements alone to Wall Street and various industries. That's a whole lot of money. Tell me what you see wrong with that and why that didn't seem to be an issue, particularly among minority voters in South Carolina. I think one man epitomized what many were feeling when I'm watching too much TV coverage of all of this, but he said, you know, we don't care how much she made her money. We just want her to be responsive to our community, and we think she is.
Yeah. Well, I can't speak for that particular person, obviously, but there's a danger in this time of suspicion of politicians, some suspicions that are very well grounded, suspicion that they're too close to Wall Street, too close to the power centers that have rigged the economy against most Americans. It is probably unwise for Hillary to have taken all of that money from Wall Street. It just creates, at the very least, an appearance of conflict of interest or impropriety, or that she is too close to Wall Street. And I think that if Donald Trump becomes the Republican nominee, And in the event that Hillary becomes the Democratic nominee, he's going to hammer her with that, even though, ironically, he's a billionaire. He's obviously used government for his own purposes. But this makes her vulnerable in ways that were not necessary.
Mm-hmm. As you well know, you're a very well-respected economist. There were economists who tried to naysay Bernie Sanders' economic plans, you know, free college for all, terrific idea. But how in the world are we going to pay for all that he wants to give us? It's pie in the sky.
Well, I don't think it's pie in the sky at all, Kathleen, because the heart of Bernie Sanders' economic plan is something called a single-payer health care plan, which would be far more efficient than anything we have now. Our health care system now, even under the Affordable Care Act, is still based on private for-profit health insurers who spend a huge amount of money, as do the drug companies, on advertising, on marketing, on promotion, on administrative costs, on high executive salaries. And so a single-payer plan, such as European countries, most other advanced industrial countries have, is not only capable of providing high-quality health care to more people, but also at a much, much lower cost. And we know this. The evidence is very, very clear. And that's where the savings occur. That's why Bernie can generate so much greater economic growth and so much greater productivity, because we've got all of those savings from not having to pay out of our ears for health care, and so many Americans not even having it to begin with.
Mm-hmm. You did write something recently which really gave me pause when you said, step back from the campaign fray for a moment and consider the enormity of what's occurred. A 74-year-old Jew from Vermont describes himself as a Democratic socialist, wasn't even a Democrat until recently, came within a whisker of beating Hillary Clinton in Iowa, routed her in New Hampshire, and did get over 40% of the caucus goers in Nevada, and a 69-year-old billionaire who's never held elective office or had anything to do with the Republican Party has taken a commanding lead in the Republican primaries. What a race this is.
Well, it was completely unexpected to the Republican and Democratic establishments, obviously, who really almost, I think 6 months ago, were saying that Hillary Clinton and also Jeb Bush were shoo-ins. Because, you see, they were the establishment candidates, and the establishment, the Republican and Democratic Party establishments, completely missed this very great wave, this surge of distrust, of anti-establishment feeling, of Americans who have had it with politics as usual, who just don't trust that anything is going to change, and really do feel that the game is rigged against them with some reason.
Let's go to a few phone calls for you. Former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich is with us. He's Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He's written a number of books, and he's extremely politically active. He writes, you may not agree with all that he says, but he's a prolific writer and economist and well worth reading. So look up Robert Reich online or read any of his books, also highly entertaining. He, just a few days ago, said that he was endorsing Senator Bernie Sanders for president. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, love to hear your comments there, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Willem and Colfax, our first caller. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I agree with a lot of what he's saying about the way our system is rigged, and I think that it reminds me of the example, I think a perfect example of this, especially like a lot of money in politics and how it affects our policies. I think our state is a great example of that, where there was someone that contributed $100,000 to our governor's campaign, and then they rewrote certain environmental laws to make it easier for this man to open a mine in a pristine part of Wisconsin's wilderness. But, you know, because of the economy, he decided to pull out. But the political strings were being pulled, and I think the same thing that you mentioned about a demagogue or someone like that, I think that our governor represents a person like that who's willing to use divisive measures, pit working people against other working people in order to achieve the goals of the people who support him financially. So I think that what you're saying is a kind of a living example in our state.
Secretary Reich.
Well, I think it's very sad what's happening, not only in Wisconsin, but around the country. I travel a great deal. I talk to many average working Americans who say that the government is no longer theirs. It's somebody else's. It's working for the rich, for the wealthy, for the well-connected. All you have to do is follow the money. I mean, we see exactly what's happening and why if you follow the money. There is a great deal of I think we have to use the word corruption. There's no better word for it. If you are a governor or you're a member of Congress or you are a presidential candidate and you're raking in a lot of money from special interests that are very big and very powerful, who stand to gain a lot if you were elected, well, there's going to be a quid pro quo. There's going to be a deal. You're not, these groups are not giving you so much money out of the goodness of their hearts. They're making investments, and those investments will pay off if the person is elected. And this has got to end. It's corroding, it's undermining, it's ultimately destroying our democracy.
Let's go to Richard in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Well, I also feel the burn, but I have some serious criticisms, mainly of the Democrats, because I consider what's going on, the Republican side is insane. Yet all of the economic analysis that I read is concerned with banking, markets, trade deficits, interest rates, that sort of thing. But there are two main issues which I think are of transcend these all of these things. One is the fact that technology seems to be making workers redundant, and more important, nobody is talking about global warming's effect on the economy and how we are to cope economically with that phenomenon.
Secretary Reich.
Well, Richard is exactly right. I think the way we talk about the economy in terms of the normal economic indicators, markets and stock markets and banking and trade deficits, miss what's really happening. Most people really don't live in that kind of economy. They live in an economy of jobs and wages, and an economy that is being affected, exactly as Richard says, by factors such as technological change and global warming. And if we don't face this stuff, that is, if we don't ask ourselves in a very, very clear way, what are we going to get if we continue to move toward a more globalized and more technological economy without any safety nets for people who are falling out because their wages are dropping or their jobs are being replaced, then we're in trouble. If we think we're in trouble now with a demagogue called Trump, we're going to be in far greater trouble later on. Global warming is imposing a clear and present danger on the U.S. economy and many other economies, and it's hitting hardest on poor people who live in low-lying areas that are easily flooded or who are going to be the first to feel the droughts or the hurricanes, who live in places and in inhabitants that are very, very fragile. It's happening around the world. Global warming is an inequality, and widening inequality can't be separated.
Are you going to support Hillary Clinton if Bernie Sanders does not receive the nomination?
Absolutely, Kathleen. I think the alternative, if the alternative is Donald Trump, is unthinkable. I mean, to have I want to be very respectful in my language here, and I'm going to try to be.
You don't have to be.
Well, we have he's an authoritarian. And I believe he is bringing out the worst in Americans. And he's legitimizing a kind of language and a kind of racism and xenophobia that we haven't seen in this country at least in 70 years. Mm. I mean, there were people like Father Coughlin, mm-hmm. The radio Nazi. I think that's a fair way of talking about him. In the 1930s, you had George Wallace, Governor George Wallace of Alabama in the 1960s, but I don't think we've ever had a candidate that was as clearly fomenting divisions of race, ethnicity, and religion the way that Donald Trump is doing it. And that divide and conquer strategy is, it's sickening.
Mm-hmm. It is sickening. Richard, thanks for the call. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. If you hang out in small Wisconsin pubs, and I'm not saying that I do or I don't, or if you hang out with university graduate types, which I'm not saying I do or I don't, there's a real disconnect because the university graduate types that I'm hanging out with, and they seem to be intelligent people, keep talking about the cynicism of the American voter in terms of backing Donald Trump. And I don't think it's the voters who are cynical. I mean, I think the American voters want to trust people. They want leaders who, when they say there are weapons of mass destruction and their kids volunteer to go into service and serve overseas, and many don't come back, many come back damaged. I really do think we're living in, you know, thank you for your guests, but I see Donald Trump in these circumstances up against Hillary Clinton in the fall as a highly electable figure. Mm. I really do.
Yeah, Rich, I tend to agree with you, sadly, and it worries me and even frightens me, because I think that there are so many Americans who are, as you say, so disillusioned, so angry, so fed up with our political system, feel like with some reason that the entire system is loaded against them, and they're lashing out. Donald Trump is a bully. And a cynical bully, but they say to themselves, well, maybe we need a cynical bully to straighten everything out. I think that's the same kind of logic that led to Mussolini and Franco and Hitler and a lot of dictators around the world who did horrible things, but I understand it. And I think that the fault lies fundamentally not in those voters, but in the circumstances we find ourselves in this country right now, and which is why we've got to get big money out of politics, why I'm supporting Bernie Sanders, why we have to have a major movement, a people's movement, to reform our political and economic system.
And has Bernie gathered that? Is it still gaining steam, or has it reached its peak, Robert Reich?
Well, it's a good question. You know, in this election year, anybody who is a political forecaster ought to be finding himself or herself eating a crow, because every political forecast has been wrong so far. They said that, for example, that Bernie Sanders would never do very well in a place like Nevada. When in fact he did extraordinarily well. Mm-hmm. I think it was about 47% of the Democratic vote. They poo-pooed the possibility that Bernie Sanders could do well in Iowa originally, and he just about beat Hillary Clinton in Iowa. So I don't know. Today, much of the media is saying, well, Hillary is obviously the candidate from here on, using that momentum theory of politics. But you have big, big primary states ahead. You've got California and New York and Massachusetts. Well, Massachusetts will be today. But you have Texas. You've got a lot of them that we just don't know how they're going to go. And it's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, it will. Robert Reich, always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Kathleen, thank you.
Robert Reich, he is former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. Even went out on a date once, he confessed to us, with Hillary Clinton. They went to a movie back when they were at school together. He's Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley and Senior Fellow at the Center for Developing Economies, author of all kinds of books, the latest being Saving Capitalism. Founding editor he is of the American Prospect magazine, and recently stepped down as chair of Common Cause as he announced his support for Senator Bernie Sanders for president. We are going to continue on this Super Tuesday, a discussion, and we'll move more to the Republican side now in the ascendancy of Donald Trump. Margaret Tolov will be joining us, works for Bloomberg, covers the White House, the 2016 Republicans, and foreign policy in presidential elections. She's a board member of the White House Correspondents Association and president of the Washington Press Club Foundation. Margaret will be joining us in a moment. Stay where you are. If you're on the line, we'll keep taking many of your calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Margaret is joining us now, and we'll continue to welcome phone calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Margaret, hello. Thank you ever so much for being with us. Oops, I got the wrong thing here. Hi, Margaret. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello.
Hi.
Happy Election Day.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a wild one. So I've been hearing this phrase, the death of the Republican Party, a whole lot in the last couple of days, and people are getting a little nervous. Are we witnessing a major realignment, restructuring of the Republican Party?
We may be, and it may take us all the way through the convention and through the November elections and the implications in terms of control of the Senate to really watch this play out. I'm looking at a couple of things beyond Donald Trump, which, of course, we're all looking at. But it is what role does the new House Speaker, Paul Ryan, take? We've seen him take a tentative posture so far, not wanting to, you know, feeling that he should take a stand, draw the line on issues like bigotry, but at the same time still saying even today that he plans on supporting the Republican nominee, no matter who it is. This is a real test for him to differentiate himself from John Boehner. It is a real test for, you know, quote-unquote, who controls the Republican Party. Is it the party chairman, or does the party chairman consider himself more of a facilitator and administrator? If nothing else, it is fair to say that this caught the Republicans in the establishment by surprise.
Absolutely.
And in contrast to kind of earlier days, you know, the days before Twitter and kind of fragmentation of society and stuff, it's just a different time. I mean, you can't imagine something, a narrative like this playing out 20 years ago.
I can't imagine the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, throwing full support to Donald Trump after what he had to say today and what he had to say about Donald Trump's plans to keep all Muslims from coming into the United States. His language was pretty forceful this morning.
And yet, his language did not call out Trump explicitly. We all knew who he was talking about, mm-hmm. but he didn't really go there. And he didn't say that there was a chance that he would, you know, sit this one out or vote for a Democrat if that's what it came to. So there are sort of different thresholds of taking a stand, and he's still trying to find the spot that he's comfortable in. How assertive is he willing to be when he's supposed to remain neutral heading into a convention? You're seeing many Republicans who, not just the candidates themselves, but kind of in the think tank class or the political class, who didn't think it was appropriate to get involved a number of weeks ago, now all of a sudden feeling that they should. But so once the dust settles, how does this change anything? And in terms of Republican strategy, does this remain sort of, is the thought that this is about Trump and not about anything else? Or is there a real rethinking of, you know, filibusters, judicial votes, compromise on legislation, about reengaging in a different way across the partisan aisle to effect any kind of a change?
So what happened? How did the Republican Party find itself in this pickle where they have this billionaire bully who's now supposedly their guy that everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people are voting for and will vote for today? How did it happen?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be dissected.
It will.
You know, books and political science classes for decades to come, right? But it seems just instinctively that there are a few different forces at hand. One is that it turns out that Donald Trump's like a really good candidate, right? He's like smart and strategic and wily and thinks well on his feet. He has a good pulse for where people are at and a good understanding of how to move the levers around. And he has huge name recognition,
yes,
right? Because he's a reality TV star. So there's that. But there are obviously a couple of other factors at hand, and one is the rise of the Tea Party, which really took hold because the presidency of Barack Obama existed, because of the 2008 financial crisis, because of the global economy, globalization, the implications of that in Rust Belt areas, right? There's that. There was the effort spearheaded by Mitch McConnell, beginning almost a decade ago now, to ramp up congressional obstruction on Democratic policies that the Republicans wanted to take a stand against and the threat of filibusters. There were kind of all of these forces working. And then kind of a vacuum in terms of the heir apparent to the Republican nomination. Everyone thought in the beginning it was probably going to be Jeb Bush, but it turned out that he was just sort of out of step or out of feel with the time, and there was no clear plan B to emerge after that. When you look at Cruz and Rubio and all these kind of relatively new senators, and then a handful of governors that all had their own limitations or problems. And so kind of the absence of an obvious nominee, the stratification inside the Republican Party, and the lingering, you know, both angst and fury from 2008 and changing demographics in this country, and there you have it. I mean, it's like a powder keg.
Yeah. But the other thing, maybe I just don't want to come to the realization that I live in an America where a whole lot of people feel this way, and it is, after all, 2016. But this, I wonder if he's deliberately using this, you know, David Duke, I don't know who he is, you know, the white supremacy movement, I don't know what it is, and then, oh, I couldn't hear in my earpiece. Of course, I disavow him. The whole thing, the anti-Muslim, the anti-Mexican rhetoric. Is that all carefully calculated? And please tell me why, in 2016, people wouldn't just immediately turn off a candidate who speaks like that.
Right. Don't forget the woman stuff, too.
Absolutely. Right. Right.
I mean, it's probably not an approach that would work as well in the Democratic primary.
Mm-mm.
And it's probably not an approach that would work as well in a general election. But within the Republican Party, this is a minority of voters who identify as Republicans. But when you started out with a candidate field of, you know, almost 20 rivals, then the kind of slivers that go to each candidate make it, there's like a sort of a divide and conquer dynamic going on here. So there are enough disaffected, frustrated Americans who in some cases are white and in some cases are men, but not in all cases. There are women or Latino Republican identifiers for whom the immigration message appeals or the Trump's Muslim message appeals. There are, you know, men for whom the woman messages appeal and vice versa, and you can kind of slice and dice like this. And it's a primary election strategy. It's not a general election strategy. So the question obviously becomes, if Trump does emerge as the nominee, do we hear him completely recast the way he talks about issues heading into a general election? And is the ultimate Democratic nominee, who looks poised to be Hillary Clinton at this point, going to be successful if they just haul out every, you know, video and audio right. and print statement of everything Donald Trump has ever said that kind of falls into that divisive category, or will it not stick the way it didn't stick in the Republican primary? And these are some of the questions that the Clinton campaign is beginning to grapple mm-hmm. with in earnestness now as they turn towards a general strategy.
What do you know about what's going on behind the scenes to deny Donald Trump the nomination? There's talk of another party maybe that people are somewhat serious about, a brokered convention, or are they going to unite around him?
Right. I mean, I think unite around him is in the eye of the beholder. I don't think that everyone who's objecting now is going to turn on their heels, about face, and kind of get religion on the subject, as it were. But the question of how this plays out between now and convention time or at the convention is still very much in flux. And as I was saying earlier, I do think that one of the big questions that's yet to be determined is what is Paul Ryan going to do? What is the House Speaker going to do? He was brought into this job. He was brought into this job, which he was not seeking to lead, because there was no other obvious person. He is, if not the leader of the Republican Party, one of the leaders of a Republican Party that doesn't have a whole lot of structure or leadership to it in the conventional sense anymore. And it just seems obvious to me that he is still seeking his footing and trying to figure out where to put his thumb on the scale. And so is the Republican congressional leadership, that the structure that exists underneath him to support him.
We're going to do it.
And also, yeah. And don't forget, I mean, that he was the vice presidential nominee, that
right.
he's someone who's been eyed as a presidential candidate before, that he has been sort of one of the kind of younger generation of Republicans leadership who's been eyed as future presidential material.
Yeah. Margaret Tolov is our guest. This part of the show works for Bloomberg, where she covers the White House, 2016 Republicans and the role of foreign policy in presidential elections. And our phone lines are filled on this Super Tuesday, I imagine they would be. 800-486-8655 is our number. Caroline in Madison, hi.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Hi. I got on the line with, with the previous
Robert Reich.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I was pondering the situation in our country, which is similar to, at least in mood, to what happened after World War One in Germany, where there was no support and people were desperate and angry and needed people to blame. And it led to quite an authoritarian figure who carried out his divisive policies. Contrary to that, in World War II, we instituted the Marshall Plan, which was massive investment in Germany, which seems to me to be more like Bernie Sanders' plan. I am wondering, since I'm speaking to a Republican, are you concerned?
She's a reporter. She's not a Republican.
Authoritarian.
Just to make it clear, she covers the White House for Bloomberg.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
Are you concerned about this authoritarian process? And my further point is that there's been such an erosion of education in the United States, so that people are very bendable, sheep-like, to follow someone who says they're going to save them.
Caroline.
Caroline, thanks for the question. So, I mean, I think the question about authoritarianism is a really interesting one in terms of how the media has approached trying to cover the story, because, look, I'm not a columnist. I'm not an editorial writer. I'm a journalist. I cover, you know, events and talk to experts about the implications. And for all of us who are in that boat, the evolving story of Donald Trump and his candidacy has created, you know, challenges that we're really not accustomed to.
I imagine.
Yeah, in terms of how to tell this story, how to, whether to put any sort of analytical filter on the story or just go to rallies and cover them to some extent on a parallel track. Reporters were going through much of the process that Republican candidates have gone through in terms of, do you just sort of stand back and let it happen and tell the story, or do you put this in historical context and in a critical context? The world is different than it was in the 1930s and 1940s, and media coverage is different also, and so they're not parallel stories. But Donald Trump has raised a number of themes in a number of ways that have been extremely divisive and created a real debate about all of these issues.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think, it's a general question, but I think it's a fair one, that of the fairly easy, maybe up until recently, media, not endorsement, but all of this time they've given him. I mean,
right.
Even liberal TV stations cut to his rallies, and you have to listen to this guy ad infinitum, ad nauseum. There he is all the time.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the media played a role in fueling the exposure and rise of Donald Trump. Initially, in a very uncritical way. Now, the coverage has become much more critical in recent weeks, and I think you've seen that play out over the issue of David Duke, over questioning Trump more explicitly on some of his plans and on the nature of some of his comments. Most candidates, even presidential candidates, cannot just call in a show at the last minute and get as much airtime as they want, coverage of them giving plane rides to children, all of this stuff.
Right.
Because in the beginning it was a novelty, because, let's be honest, there were ratings and everyone wanted ratings.
Absolutely. There you go.
And
let's make some more money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Caroline, very much for your call. Rick in Monona, hi.
Hi, I'm enjoying the conversation. My question is, I wanted to take it back to the racial element of the campaigns and the campaigners on the GOP side. I think after Obama was elected that Republicans really were frightened of voting of black and brown people and poor people. And I think there's been an effort nationally to stop those people that from voting to actually, that they actually threaten the white establishment, the white wealthy establishment, and they've implemented things like gerrymandering and voter IDs. And I think that some of these candidates, in fact, all of them seem to be anti-Mexican immigrant. It's like they fear the brown and black people. And I know that there's white race in America is already or will soon be a minority. And I almost think that they're setting the stage to maintain their power when that happens by keeping people from voting.
Margaret, I'm sorry, we need to move. We have so many calls. Margaret, what do you say?
You know, some of these issues like turnout in Florida or long lines or all this kind of stuff, you know, it certainly predated President Obama's election. It was going on back during the Bush v. Gore years and even before then. And these questions and issues that have been raised by civil rights groups really go back to, you know, the 1960s. I'll say that, first of all, I think there are many office holders in the Republican Party who do not want to isolate Muslims, Latinos, women, all these various groups, any Republican strategist, morality or what's in your heart aside, can look at the changing demographics and see that that's not a winning approach, right?
Right.
So, in a way, what Donald Trump has been doing and how it may play out in the general risks not suppressing those votes, but doing the opposite, increasing turnout on behalf of the Democrats.
Well,
potentially, but it's very hard to predict.
Yeah, I heard some, I think it was Jonathan Alter, say the other day, and I can't remember the percentage he used, but Donald Trump would have to win a certain percentage of the Latino vote, and you can't imagine that would be anything but minuscule after what he said.
Well, although it's hard to say, you know, there have been some reports from the Texas border, Latino voters who are second, third, fourth generation Americans who also don't like illegal immigration, who also would like to see, you know, a wall, whether that's an actual physical wall or a virtual wall, whatever, barriers to prevent illegal immigration because it adds to crime at the border, it takes away resources for schools and hospitals and all this sort of stuff. So, and because Trump is a very dynamic candidate whose not just message but sort of delivery style actually appeals to a lot of people, you're seeing today on Super Tuesday in Massachusetts some reports of, you know, thousands of former Democrats changing their registration to independent Republican. And some of them may be, you know, trying to vote for Trump to stack the decks to help Hillary Clinton in the fall, but others of them may just want to support Donald Trump, you know. You think you know what's happening, but it turns out that when you peel the onion back a little bit, his candidacy really is it's just hard to sum up that quickly. There's a lot of different factors going on.
Well, start that book, Margaret. I think it's time. Yeah. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this half hour of the show is Margaret Tolliff. She is covering the White House for Bloomberg, covers 2016 Republican race and the role of foreign policy in presidential elections. Our phone number for you to join this Super Tuesday conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, where we'd love to read your comments about, you know, what do you make of all that's going on in this race? What do you make of Donald Trump? Is Hillary Clinton pretty much going to be the Democratic nominee? And if so, are you happy with that? What do you think about the role of money in politics? What do you think about the initial momentum that Bernie Sanders had that seems to be fading somewhat? What's that all about? But mostly I'm interested in your thoughts about, Donald Trump. He's bound to win a whole lot tonight. And as Margaret said, I welcome somebody writing a book about all of this because I sure don't get it. We are going to take more of your phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More phone calls from Margaret. Rick, thanks very much for your call. And let's go to Harold in Tomahawk. Hi, Harold.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'll first make this comment. I've been a Democrat for over 30 years. And I'm about to vote for Donald Trump because he is not a career politician. And that's one of the biggest reasons why I'd vote for him. The other problem I have is the health care. This Obamacare said that they were going to provide affordable health care. Now I work 6-7 days a week. My wife works a full-time job, and I'm a truck driver. Now, they want me to pay $240 a month for me and $240 a month for my wife. That means $480 a month with a $6,000 deductible. I'm sorry, but if I could afford that, I'd be driving two brand new cars instead of the old pieces of junk I have.
What do you think about a single payer system, Harold? Would you be supportive of that? Harold?
Yeah, what's that?
Single payer. What do you think about a single payer system?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Single payer health care. What would you think of that as an alternative?
I'm not sure if that's going to help it out either. I mean, we're just, it's a mess. I mean, my sister works for the Minnesota based hospital. Oh, I can't think of the name of it now. But anyway, she went in front of Congress and told them all of this stuff was not going to work, and they just laughed at her.
Margaret, well, there's a voice of somebody who's what we're hearing. You know, people are hurting. People are having a hard time making ends meet.
Yeah, Harold, I don't know if you're still on the call, but I would be really curious about whether you think that Donald Trump will be able to change things, or whether you're pretty sure that he won't, but you think it's important to make the point by showing Congress that voters will replace them with mm-hmm. outsiders.
Mm.
Well, I'm kind of hoping that one thing he'll do is tell them that the insurance companies to either give health insurance that's affordable, like $120 a month per person and a $1,000 deductible. Force them to make that and let us, and then we'll pay it. But this $6,000 deductible with $480 a month?
Yeah, okay. We hear you. Thanks, Harold, very much for your call. Let's go to Kesser in Germantown. Hi.
Yes, I'm a minority in this country, naturalized citizen. I compare Donald Trump with the lizard called chameleon that changes its colors based on, you know, the environment. And I listen to his speeches a lot because I want to know what, you know, somebody who could really affect me or my children's lives, what is he saying? And I know a lot about David Duke, and even though I was not born here, but I know a lot about him because I want to know who David Duke is. I'm not afraid of David Duke because I know what his limits are. So I'm prepared if I am confronted with David Duke. I know who he is, and I can deal with that. But I'm afraid of Donald Trump taking over this country. Somebody who changes his mood based on the hype that is created around him.
Margaret.
Not to underplay the actual emotional importance of what you're saying, but just to make a political point, I think the Republicans are in the same boat because if he becomes their nominee, they're really not sure that, I mean, you know, that he's going to do the stuff he's been talking about on the campaign trail that they want either. And so that's part of the reason why you see it's not just the kind of, you know, some of the ethnically, racially, gender offensive stuff that they're afraid will, you know, could hurt the rest of the party. But It is like, is he really our guy? You know, like if he gets elected, can Congress count on him
right.
as a partner?
Right. Absolutely.
And there is a real unknown. I mean, if you have, there are books available. They're actually really fun, like sort of quote Trump quotes from the last 25 years. You know, you go back to the 90s or something and compare things that he said about abortion or any number of issues, and they've just wildly fluctuated. And of course, politicians have a right to change their mind, but he's taken it to new levels.
Yeah. One more phone call. Diane, we have about a minute left from Madison. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. I was a child during World War II, and I asked grown-ups, how did Nazism happen? And nobody had an easy answer. But one that rose big and strong was, so many people were in poverty after World War I in Germany. There was a tremendous inflation and dreadful poverty. They were looking for some leader to help them get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
The anger and the poverty brought them a leader, and he played on it, and that was Hitler. America is poor. America is lost right now, and I don't want to see this repeated.
Thanks, Margaret. Margaret, thanks, Diane, very much for your call. And Margaret, thank you so much for being with us. Please join us again during this incredible season. Oh,
yeah,
my gosh.
It's been my pleasure. I'd be delighted to
thank you.
That.
Thanks. We will definitely call you. Margaret Tolov works for Bloomberg. She covers the White House, 2016 Republicans, and also foreign policy in presidential elections. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this program. Thanks to KP Whaley for all of his help. And thanks to Robert Reich, former Secretary Secretary of Labor, for joining us the first half hour of today's program on this Super Tuesday. A reminder, tomorrow we'll analyze all that happened today. Listen, the analysis is going to go on for years with this one, don't you think? A Super Tuesday recap tomorrow with Molly Ball from The Atlantic and Orrin Cass of the Manhattan Institute. News coming up.